with infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio on Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. This is the zombie edition of Savage Science, so gear up and get your iron stomach on. Some of these stories are brought to you from Mother Earth, and we all know how gross she can get. Others are brought to you from the crazy that only humans can think up and call entertainment. Check your doors. You might not want to go outside for a while after you hear this episode. Well, not without a baseball bat and some heavy shoes on.
Tree!
for our first story tonight, zombie snails. Yes, those little creatures that are out there crawling through your strawberries, eating them right now. Infecting a snail, the life cycle of the grossest parasite. From barnacles that hijack crabs to a protozoan that makes rodents cozy up to cats, parasites do a lot more than make you puke. But for sheer gross-out glory, it's hard to beat Leucochloridium paradoxum. These flatworms live in birds' rectums, and they give garden snails a glimpse of hell. First stage. A grazing snail eats bird dropping. Gross, right? Well, what's even grosser is that the bird dropping is filled with parasite eggs. Garden snails can't digest these eggs. They survive their trip to the snail's tummy intact and spread to nearby organs. Second stage. The invading Leucochloridium runs through a couple of life cycle stages before landing in the snail's hepatopancreas. This is the organ that passes for its liver pancreas thing. Okay, third stage. The parasite pumps embryo after embryo into fat, throbbing brood sacs it builds into the snail's eye stalks. Fourth stage. Now an intelligent designer might have stopped at systemic infection and pulsating, and the brightly colored tentacles. But not evolution, though. Evolution goes to 11. The parasite takes control of the snail's rudimentary brain, making the mollusk forget that it's scared of daylight and spurring it to inch out into the open. Fifth stage. Now to us, the infected tentacles look like a fleshy Cronenbergian nightmare, but to birds they look like delicious caterpillars. Yum. Sixth stage. Now the birds eat the eye stalks and get infected by the parasites, which produce and lay eggs in the bird's rectum, ready to be deployed in future poop. Seventh stage. Even if the snails survive the destocking, they stay parasitized, which means that they can infect other birds, which can then infect other snails. It's the circle of life. Mind-controlling parasites. This parasite is called Leucochloridium paradoxum, but there are many other mind-controlling parasites, such as the Spinocordotes telenae. This one infects grasshoppers and forces them to drown themselves. This is where the worm reproduces. Oh, and there's one of my favorites, which is the Toxoplasma gondii. That's found in cats' intestines, which creates a condition known as toxoplasmosis in humans and poses a special danger to pregnant women. That's why we don't let them clean out the cat boxes. But I'll let you all look it up. Savor the knowledge. Now here's a question, not one that's on everybody's lips, granted, okay, but a question nonetheless. How do ants know when another ant is dead? E.O. Wilson, now the most celebrated, most eminent ant scholar in the world, wanted to know, am I dead? When Ed Wilson was a young assistant professor at Harvard in the 1950s, he observed that when ants die, and if they're not crushed or torn apart, they just lay there, sometimes upside down, feet in the air, while their sister ants, almost all ants in a colony are ladies, walk right by without looking at them. That is until about 2 days after an ant's passing, Ed discovered, when the corpse appears to emit a chemical signal that changes the living ant's behavior dramatically. All of a sudden, what was once a pile of gunk on the colony floor becomes a problem to be solved. Once the signal is in the air, any ant that happens by grabs the corpse and carries it through the colony to a refuse pile designated the graveyard and dumps it on a mound of also dead ants. Ed, who had revolutionized the study of ants by exploring their ability to communicate with smell, decided to figure out what chemicals equal "I am dead" to an ant. In his autobiography, Naturalist, he wrote, "I thought maybe with the right chemicals I could create an artificial corpse." In the NPR broadcast on All Things Considered, Ed describes how he researched the likely chemical constituents of "I am dead." They included scatol, which is a component of feces, trimethylamine, which is one of the essences of rotting fish, and several of the more pungent fatty acids that contribute to rancid human body odor, Ed says. "For weeks, my laboratory smelled like the combined essences of sewer, garbage dump, and locker room." Finally, after much sifting and mixing, Ed discovered that oleic acid, just a teeny drop of it, was all the ants had to sniff to think dead. And because he could, Ed had a colony parked in his Harvard lab so he could watch them endlessly. One day, he took a drop of the chemical and gently deposited it on an ant that had the misfortune of walking by. Ed describes how as soon as he dabbed that ant, the next ant came near and grabbed this ant, slung it on its back, and hiked over to the graveyard. And though the ant was very much alive, kicking, you know, says Ant, flung it onto the refuse pile. Dead is what you smell, not what you see, if you're an ant. So, though it tried to clean itself over and over, the minute it returned to the colony, it was grabbed and carried and slung back onto the pile. Didn't you take the pity? The reporter asked Ed. You started it. Didn't you give it a shower or something? No. I was trying to see if I could create the living dead, he says, while making zombie motions with his head and hands. He confesses that it took the ant roughly an hour or two to get clean enough to return to regular business. Yes, Ed was naughty, but he had a wonderful time offending all the folks on his floor in the biology department. And what Ed was discovering is that most organisms on Earth do not communicate by sight and sound. He was among the first to realize that an enormous number of creatures, ants included, share information by taste and smell, even if those smells are what technologically sophisticates would call yucky. You can hear the audio from E.O. Wilson's interview on NPR.
Extremist religious groups in proclaiming the phenomenon a sign of a coming apocalypse, although Downing Street is refusing to be drawn into a religious debate. Once again, the bodies of the recently deceased are returning to life and attacking the living. There is no indication as to how or indeed why.
We'll be right back.
And this is from a Science Now story that was published online in July of this year. Bacteria brings leaves back from the dead. When the leaves they depend on turn a deathly yellow in the fall, leaf miner moths, Phylonorector blancardella, perform CPR. Even as the rest of the leaf wilts, the patch surrounding the leaf miner larva stays a bright and photosynthetically active green. Now, a new study shows that these green islands spark to life thanks to bacteria living within these grubs themselves. Like mammals, many insects host internal microbes called endosymbionts that help them digest meals, often passing these friends from generation to generation. Now, insect endosymbionts have also proven themselves keen investigators developing new defenses for their hosts. The more we look at endosymbionts in insects, the more people find interesting and new functions, says ecologist David Guérin of the University Francois Rabelais in Tours, France. It seemed possible to Guérin that bacteria like those in the genus Robachia, which dwell in leaf miners, could also rewire plant metabolism. Many microbes, including Wolbachia, carry a gene also found in plants that spurs some plant cells to make hormones called cytokinins. He says cytokinins, which delay death in plants, can spur green islands on their own and are plentiful in leaf miner islands. To determine whether the bacteria nurtured the green islands, Guérin and colleagues gave some female leaf miners oral doses of insect-safe antibiotics to kill their microbial partners. The researchers allowed the insects to lay eggs as usual on apple tree leaves. Larvae from untreated mothers were able to form green islands, but larvae from dosed moms were not. Without bacteria, you don't have green islands, and if you don't have green islands, you die, Guérin says. The team reported the results online in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B. The researchers don't yet know if Wolbachia bacteria are making cytokinins on their own or if they're triggering plant life support through other means. In a previous study, however, scientists discovered that birch tree infecting leaf miners could churn out cytokinins, but they didn't investigate whether these hormones came from the insects or their endosymbionts. Regardless of how they work, the bacteria are valuable compatriots. In dying leaves, green islands buy the moths as much time as, say, an extra month to reproduce and grow, the researchers suspect. With that additional time, leaf miners may be able to sneak in an extra generation of grubs before winter. It's a beautiful example of how an organism can solve a major problem by getting into a mutually beneficial relationship with the microbe, says chemical ecologist Ian Baldwin of the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology in Jena, Germany. He says that there are a lot of unanswered questions and wants to know things like whether Wolbachia living outside of the insect bodies can still manage this breath of life. But the study shows just how much an insect's success is the work of its inner bugs, he says. One can safely say that most insects are just Trojan horses. I want to thank Marcus Leder for sending me this great story, and you can find out more in news.sciencemag.org. Marcus's show is Shaman's Brew, which is 2 hours prior to mine, on this station, Jackalope 105 FM. He is awesome.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay. Except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die screaming, oh! I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should come. compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brain. I don't want to nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. You open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat. I'd like to help you, Tom, in any way I can. I sure appreciate the way you're working with me. I'm not a monster, Tom. Well, technically I am. I guess I am. Ground somehow. Meanwhile, I'll report back to my colleagues who were chewing on the doors. I guess we'll table this for now. I'm glad to see you take constructive criticism well. Thank you for your time. I know we're all busy as hell, and we'll put this thing to bed when I bash your head open.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. Open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains.
It's late at night. You're home alone, about to go to sleep. Suddenly, you hear scratching at the window. You stop and listen. A branch, maybe? You try to shut out the sound, get into your pajamas, turn out the light. But the scratching continues, only now it's getting a little louder, more frequent. And you swear you can hear moaning and groaning. Is it the neighbors? You put on the radio to drown out the noise, fall into a restless sleep. Crash! Something just woke you up. You sit up in bed and look around. The bedroom door opens, and before you see anything, you can smell it. Death. Dead skin and rotten insides. You're paralyzed with fear. It's like you're watching this happen to somebody else. A face appears from behind the door, then another, then another, then another. Why didn't you pay attention to the noises? But there's no point in asking questions now. There's a pack of zombies that have just cornered their prey. You. Fear not, zombie hunters. There are ways to survive if, perchance, the government releases a virus or detonates a bomb that turns 99% of us into the undead.
Who is this irresistible creature who has an insatiable love for the dead?
We'll be right back. step on the stage is only one throw away to bring the giant down. Deep on the streams, immaterial things, with a one flat foot on the devil's wings.
First off, don't negotiate with these things. These zombies don't hear you. What you say is gonna fall on deaf ears, or more like, dead ears. According to Max Brooks, the author of The Zombie Survival Guide, the parts of the brain that control memory are liquefied and used by the zombie virus to create more viruses and destroy motor functions. The body exists just to keep the brain alive. So if your spouse, parent, or friend has become a zombie, do not give in to the horror movie conventions by saying, "Don't you remember? It's your old buddy Frank," because, just like in the movies, it's not gonna work. Zombies are driven by the desire to feed. We're not sure why, Brooks says. They don't use it for food. Indeed, none of the usual bodily functions are at play in a zombie. No oxygen is needed, no blood, nor nourishment, excretion, and definitely not sex. But what is it that turns a healthy person into the undead? Brooks believes it is a virus called solanum. We still don't know much about it. We don't know the origins of virus. It's spread through direct fluid-to-fluid contact, usually through a bite. It's not airborne, and you can't get it from a toilet seat. But in a day, you'll be dead. A day is about the mean, says Brooks. It depends on where you're bitten. If it's a vein, it goes right to the heart and is pumped through the bloodstream. So that's much faster than if you're bitten in an artery. And there is no cure.
The wind is blowing cold. Have we lost our will or not? Have we lost our hope to sorrow? Feels like we're all alone. Running for the phone, driving there no more heroes to follow. So what are we becoming? Where did we go wrong?
now that you know what drives the zombie, what's the best defense? The following are some key strong and weak points. Strong points. Their brains don't need oxygen or blood. They can withstand a heck of a lot more damage. They can attack underwater, and even a decapitated head can deliver a fatal bite. They hunt 24/7. They never sleep. They never close, says Brooks. Weak points. They're uniformly slow, cannot think, and form no strategies. So you can outrun them and outthink them. If you keep your wits about you, you're gonna be okay. It's all psychology. You almost have to become as mechanical as they are. You can't fly into a rage. You must be completely zen. They also do not have superhuman strength, unless they had a superhuman strength as a human. So should you be more afraid of Mike Tyson zombie than, say, a Larry David one? A good head on your shoulders along with a survival kit will stack the odds way in your favor. Brooks' ideal survival kit is this. A water filter? This is the most important thing. Without clean water, you're dead. Comfy shoes and dry socks. Dress in layers and bring a machete. Why a machete over a shotgun? Guns need bullets. Plus, every time you fire that gun, you're telling the zombies where you are. So, it's late at night, you're in your jammies, and the zombies have just discovered you. What do you do now? Keep in mind Brooks' departing words. Don't be afraid. Use your head and cut off theirs.
Travel the world and the feathers.
A zombie is a dead person that is brought back to life through means of voodoo or necromancy, destroying the mental processes of this person through the zombification. Most people consider zombies to be the stuff of horror books and movies, but they do exist in Haiti in the present day. Thousands of people in Haiti are considered to be zombies, some of which lead normal, everyday lives with families, jobs, and are respected citizens. It's even considered to be a crime to make a zombie in Haiti. Here's the Haitian Penal Code, Article 249. It shall be qualified as attempted murder, the employment which may be made against any person of substances which, without causing actual death, produce a lethargic coma more or less prolonged, if, after the person had been buried, the act shall be considered murder, no matter what result follows. Now, to make a zombie, voodoo practitioner makes a potion that consists mainly of the poison of the pufferfish, one of the strongest nerve poisons known to man. The clinical drug Nurcurin has the same or the similar effects and is used during surgery, and that is given to the intended victim. This causes severe neurological damage, primarily affecting the left side of the brain. Now, the left side of the brain is what controls your speech, memory, and motor skills. The victim suddenly becomes lethargic and slowly seems to die. In reality, the victim's respiration and pulse becomes so slow that it is nearly impossible to detect. The victim retains full awareness as he is taken to the hospital, then perhaps to the morgue, and finally is buried alive. Then, at the voodoo practitioner's leisure, does he come to retrieve the victim, now become a slave, as a commodity? At one time, it was said that most of the slaves who worked in the sugarcane plantations of Haiti were zombies. One case in 1918 had a voodoo priest named T. Joseph, who ran a gang of laborers for the American Sugar Corporation. He took the money that they received and fed the workers on only unsalted porridge. A zombie will remain in a robot-like state indefinitely until he tastes either salt or meat. Well, so much for the Night of the Living Dead idea. Then the zombies become aware of their state, immediately returning to the grave. The reality behind the zombie has only been taken seriously by medical science within the last 10 years, since the use of CAT scans of the brain, along with the confessions of voodoo priests explaining their methods. Previous to that, zombies were considered mental defective by science and explained as stunts trying to confuse scientists. There are many examples of zombies in modern-day Haiti. Papa Doc Duvalier, the dictator of Haiti from 1957 to 1971, had a private army that was said to consist of zombies called Tonton Maquettes. These people were said to be in trances, and they followed every command that Duvalier gave them. Duvalier was also a devout voodooist, and as are many people in Haiti, who lead a voodoo church with many followers. He also claimed that he was immortal and he would rule Haiti forever, promising to return after his death to rule again. Gee, have we heard that story before? After his death, a heart attack, he did not come back, although a guard was placed at his tomb to ensure that he would not try to escape, or so someone wouldn't try to steal the body. This is a common practice in Haiti, along with padlocking of tombs for the same reason. So, there are also many stories of people that die, then many years later return to the shock and surprise of relatives. A man named Cesar returned 18 years after he died to marry and have three children and die again 30 years after he was originally buried. Another case involved a student from a village in Port-au-Prince who had been shot in a robbery attempt. 6 months later, the student returned to his parents' house as a zombie. At first, it was possible to talk with the man. He related the story of his murder and the voodoo witch doctor stealing his body from the ambulance before he reached the hospital. Now, his transformation into a zombie hadn't actually occurred yet, but as time went on, he became unable to communicate. He then grew more and more lethargic, and then he died. A case reported, a writer named Stephen Bonzel described a zombie he witnessed in 1912 in this way. A man had at intervals a high fever. He had joined a foreign mission church and was the head of the mission, and he saw the patient die. He assisted at the funeral and saw the dead man buried. Some days later, the supposedly dead man was found dressed in his grave clothes, tied to a tree, moaning. The poor wretch soon discovered his voice, but not his mind. He was identified by his wife, by the physician who had pronounced him dead, and by the clergyman. The victim recognized no one, and his days were spent moaning inarticulate words no one could understand. Now, regarding the idea with the salt and the zombies, according to Haitian folklore, like we just talked about, feeding salt to a zombie was supposed to return it to its senses. Often the zombie then attacks the bokor who made it, and it returns to the place of burial and then dies. Ironically, tetrodotoxin works by blocking the sodium channels in muscle and nerve cells. However, there's no known cure for tetrodotoxin poisoning, which comes from the pufferfish, and the amount of sodium in a few grains of salt is unlikely to have any physiological effect on a poisoned person. Now, Dr. Wade Davis has chronicled his studies of Haitian zombies in The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was made into a movie, and The Passage of Darkness. He traveled to Haiti at the request of Dr. Nathan S. Klein, who theorized that a drug was responsible for a man named Narcisse's experiences as a zombie that they were studying. Such a drug could have medical uses, particularly in the field of anesthesiology. Klein hoped to gather samples, analyze them, and determine how they worked. Now, Davis learned that Haitians who believed in zombies believed that a bokor's sorcery, not a poison or drug, created them. According to a local lore, a bokor captures the victim's tibonage, or the part of the soul directly connected to an individual, to create a zombie. But during his research, Davis discovered that the bokor used complex powders made from dried and ground plants and animals in their rituals. Davis collected 8 samples of this zombie powder in 4 regions of Haiti. Their ingredients were not identical, but 7 of the 8 samples had 4 ingredients in common. One or more species of pufferfish, which often contain a deadly neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin, a marine toad, Bufo marinus, which produces numerous toxic substances, a Hyla tree frog, which secretes an irritating but not deadly substance, and human remains. Now, in addition, the powders contained other plant and animal ingredients like lizards and spiders, which would be likely to irritate the skin, and some included ground glass. The use of pufferfish intrigued Davis. Tetrodotoxin causes paralysis and death, and the victims of tetrodotoxin poisoning often remain conscious until just before death. The paralysis prevents them from reacting to stimuli, much like what Mr. Narcisse had described about his own death. Doctors have also documented cases in which people ingested tetrodotoxin and appeared dead, but eventually made a complete recovery. Well, there you have it. A little truth and a little myth, because we all know a little truth is behind every myth. Well, this has been Savage Science, and thank you for joining us tonight. Thank you to Nick Paluco for awesome show graphics, and to Dennis Baum and Hawk Productions for the kick-ass intro music. Tune in next week for the most popular science myths, carrying on this tradition, but not with zombieism. We've already done that to death, so to speak. And a review on M. Night Shyamalan and why his movies seem to be losing the sci-fi crowd. Till then, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails.
I like it. I like the way the line runs up the back of the stockings. I've always liked those kind of high heels.